Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Free Nintendo. This is number 428. I'm your host, as always, Jonathan Metz, and with me this week, Guillaume Veillette.
More like Amiibo Tap Out, am I right?
Oh, James Jones.
DDS.
And John Lindemann.
I am the RFN number one draft pick.
Well, we have, we're bringing back the Thunder Round, as it is now going to be
Thunder
known.
Thunder Round.
The super fast sequence of listener emails coming up later in this show. I'm really looking forward to doing that again, and we're going to keep trying to do it. So thanks everyone who's been emailing so much, and it's been great. So we'll get to that a little bit later in the show, but first up is new business, and Mr. Lindemann has an interesting little topic to bring up right off the bat.
Yeah, it involves new and it involves business, and it is what I like to call the Konamalypse.
The Konamalypse?
The apocalypse that is Konami.
Oh, I don't know. James and I have been talking Konami about Geddon this. Konamigeddon sounds better, but whatever.
Touche. Touche. See, and I'm even teaching you French, Guillaume.
we had to learn it in school.
Konamigeddon. Yeah, so there was a couple of things kind of that just kind of wanted to talk about quickly. I don't really want to have a really in-depth discussion about it, but James and I have been talking about like basically what's going on at Konami.
Yep.
To start off the top, you know, they talked about, you know, how they delisted themselves off of the New York Stock Exchange this week.
Yep.
You know, on top of everything going on with Kojima and on top of Silent Hills being canceled. Apparently, yep. And the way that happened is they just let the contracts lap with Guillermo del Toro and Norman Reedus and those guys. And, of course, Kojima, because Kojima is leaving the company. And so in the midst of all that, you had them delisting from the New York Stock Exchange. So the question is – so which was great timing because everybody lost their shit at that point and thought that Konami was dead. So,
and the thing is, it had already been announced. They had announced this a while ago that they were going to do this. I think it's been a month ago.
Yeah, and but I mean all of this stuff kind of has
to do with –
it
sort of went out like with a murmur.
Yeah, and I mean a lot of this stuff has to do with, you know, I think a couple of things. Number one, it's pretty obvious that Konami is completely backing away from console development.
Absolutely.
And they're going, I mean, there was actually a great article by Rob Fahey, I think, on Gamma Sutra, I think, that talked about all of this, or maybe GameIndustry.biz, one of the two. But he went into in depth with it and kind of, you know, spelled that out very clearly, you know, broke down, you know, the last 5 years, how much income they've made from each segment of their, you know, their business, health and fitness. They run a bunch of health clubs, and you can just see there's a steady decline, and they're kind of, you know, the money that they make from games, period, which is arcade games, you know, console games, you know, smartphone games and all that kind of stuff. They're backing away from that. It's very, very clear. And it's something that they've been doing for a while. So,
oh, yeah. If you look at their output from the middle of the last console generation, well, they're putting out things like Downcoming, the two Western-made Silent Hill games that people don't really much care for.
Yep.
That they were putting out a decent clip of games. They were doing all the HD remasters. I think they had 4 or 5 games 1 year. And then if you compared that to what we made jokes about at E3 last year with the booth that had nothing in it.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, this isn't like super jarring in a way, but at the same time, it kind of is just because it's Konami.
Yeah. And you know, they're sitting on so much high profile IP. And, you know, I mean, I think for Xbox One and PS4, I believe they've only come out with one game, which is what? Pro Evolution Soccer 2015,
There's been an Evo, and didn't they make a PS4, Xbox One versions of the MGS5 demo? Paid demo?
Well, yeah, yeah. Aside from Metal Gear Solid 5,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. That's it, yeah. One thing I'd point out, though, is, I mean, they're still going to make their friggin' slot machines. They're still going to run their health clubs. But essentially, it goes into why they're delisting. So,
yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to go into detail about how Konami was listed, but they weren't selling company stock on the New York Stock Exchange. They were selling these kinds of weird international things you use to represent stock in place of actual stock.
Much the same thing that Nintendo does, correct?
Yep. And they were selling them here and in London, or New York and in London. Mm-hmm. And then they're selling their actual stock on the Nikkei, which is Japan's big stock exchange. They're still going to list in London. Yep. But they're not going to list in New York anymore. Well, part of that is because it's really expensive to list on the New York Stock Exchange. Not just the fees you have to pay for that, but there's incredibly stringent reporting requirements that you have to have about you know, financial reporting, quarterly reports, stuff like that, in order to be qualified to be on the New York Stock Exchange, and that costs a lot of money.
Correct.
So why would they still list on the London Stock Exchange, which has similar reporting rules? Because they probably plan to continue to do business in Europe, and they do have these kind of freestanding Konami arcades in Europe, I believe. But the biggest thing is, like, their Pachi slot business has a taker in Europe, whereas in North America, there's no market for that. You know, gambling is so heavily regulated in the U.S. that you don't have, you know, the fruit machine business running around in all sorts of places. Mm-hmm. So Konami's just looks at North America and goes, eh?
So, well, particular to the New York Stock Exchange stuff, the main reason why they actually did delist is because the trading, the volume of trading on their shares was so low that it wasn't even worth it. Like, I think it was something like three, there were, of the shares that were traded last year, outside of Japan, the New York Stock Exchange accounted for something like 0.3%.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Of all, I mean, we're talking like an extremely small amount, like almost no shares, almost no trades whatsoever were done. So they just said, not worth our money.
Right.
Forget it. We're not even listing on it anymore. So
it does. Why a foreign company would list on the New York Stock Exchange? I know that's that in the NASDAQ and like the Dow are the ones that get a lot of attention. There's actually dozens of stock exchanges in the U.S. you can list on. And like Nintendo doesn't list on a major stock at all. They list on a market exchange, which is the stock that almost exclusively deals in these foreign companies that don't want to follow the stringent reporting requirements of you know, these major indices. Mm-hmm. So, like, they could have dropped down to that, and maybe they will at some point. But I think I think it goes back to the question of, you know, you list on those things in order, it's kind of a prestige statement about your brand. And I do wonder if maybe they just say, well, it's just really not worth it anymore.
I think they're kind of bringing things back to Japan. It really seems that way. Like, they're more concerned with the games that they make and the money that they make in Japan than anywhere else.
Oh, absolutely. And so, this is somewhat endemic of, you know, the Japanese game developers as a whole anyway. It's just Konami's the first one that's really gone all out on it. We talk about companies that are holding licenses and doing jack shit with them anyway. I mean, you've got Konami. I mean, John and I were talking about this on Sunday. Why the hell did Konami buy Hudson?
Yeah.
Like, what was the purpose of that purchase? To go like, you're never going to get another Hudson game.
Yeah.
That is
I mean,
weird.
I think you have to wonder, though, if it was part of their long-term plan to eventually get out of consoles and just say, hey, we have these IPs. Anybody want to make something with them? Pay us. Pay us and we don't have to do anything.
So the concern that we have for our listeners is that Konami may just decide to divest themselves entirely, at which point things on their digital service may go away. Now, at the moment, we don't know that's the case. PT went away yesterday, I think. Mm-hmm. But that was almost like a symbolic gesture of them saying, this thing is dead.
Well, yeah, and it probably has more to do with legal and contract stuff than anything else.
Sure. But like things like Virtual Console entries, WiiWare, you know, games like Castlevania Rebirth.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. Like, we don't know that they're going to delist those things from the services. They may. They may just say, even having the management staff to maintain the relationship to get us our money from these services isn't worth it. But at the moment, they haven't announced anything like that. I saw some panic about that on Twitter. They will announce it ahead of time. You can go on your buying binge then.
Yeah.
At the same time, John's right. This is probably your last big Metal Gear game.
Well, yeah, they claim that they're going to be more even without Kojima, but I suspect that's going to amount to mobile games.
Yeah.
Maybe handheld games, like if they're being really ambitious. Because I think that the Metal Gear Solid 3 for 3DS, that weird like remake, it did really well. I think particularly in Japan, I think it sold really well.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, the problem is that Konami's executive board has decided they don't really want to fund these projects. And and that's actually a big burden release for them. I mean, the Metal Gear Solid games all made money, even though they're ungodly expensive.
I don't think they're especially profitable. I think they make more money than they cost, but not by a huge margin. And they cost so much in the first place.
And they take so long to realize that return.
Yep.
Because it's a high-risk maneuver, because if at some point people decide, oh, Metal Gear's hokey and it's not cool anymore and no one really is interested, you know, just like what happened with Tony Hawk. Once you get up to a certain number, it's been around for a while, or you put out too many games, you could have gotten to the point where all of a sudden they spend even more money than ever on the next Metal Gear, and yet it doesn't sell nearly as well. Call of Duty is kind of getting into this territory.
Yep.
And it's very concerning to these publishers. So I guess this whole thing, the whole situation with Konami is, you know, the reason we're talking about it is not that any of their upcoming games were really announced for Wii U or anything like that.
I mean, they had the two. That's it.
Yeah. And they weren't necessarily ever going to be relevant on Nintendo consoles ever again. But they were a classic developer and publisher of amazing games that we talk about all the time. And it is sad. Now, obviously, those games are still going to be around in some fashion, even if it's just the old cartridge that you dug up or you bought on eBay. So, you know, I think the Konami that exists today clearly is not the same. Almost all of their, you know, well-known developers are long gone.
Yep.
Kojima was actually kind of hanging on by a thread. I mean, he was like sort of the last man standing. It got to the point where every project that Konami announced had to have Kojima's name attached to it, and that's going back like 4 or 5 years. So Konami's been in bad shape for a while, and it's been really sad to see them, you know, move farther away from Nintendo and then kind of move farther away from video games, period. And I think it is honestly depressing. I mean, if you look at the grand scope of Japanese game development, this amazing cultural center of video game, you know, creation that heavily influenced all of our lives at various points, maybe all the way throughout. And I think it has increasingly become alienating to Westerners. I think it has become more sporadic in quality. And I think the overall volume has gone way, way, way down of anything that's actually relevant or worthy enough to even bother localizing into other languages. So I feel like people aren't talking about Japanese games anymore. Those games aren't selling very much anymore. Also, they're not nearly as relevant globally as they once were, which is very sad to see because they're certainly more than capable of creating interactive art that appeals to the entire world. And it's sad to me that they've become so focused on only, you know, this niche market that's hanging on there, and they have not figured out ways to get the larger populace interested in video games. And largely, you know, the kinds of stuff that Konami was good at making and was famous at making, and that Nintendo has been up till now, is not popular in Japan at all. And I don't know exactly why that is the case, but I do find it worrisome and lamentable because of how important Japan has been to all of us.
So I will say that now I got in a conversation with some people who, you know, follow the industry fairly closely, and we talk about this on the show every so often, but one of the biggest there's a two element factor here, especially in Japan, the sort of step away from console gaming in general. I mean, you go look at what the consoles that have came out in this generation have been doing in Japan in terms of their sales numbers, and it's abysmal. It's abysmal. And then there's also the sort of this kind of increased cost of producing games on these platforms. You're making increasingly expensive games for an increasingly smaller number of people. So
yeah, and to be clear, also I want to point out even the 3DS isn't doing nearly as well as the DS did.
Oh no.
So yeah. It's certainly more popular than any console right now. The 3DS is a relatively big deal in Japan, but it is way down from where they've been in the past.
Yeah, and it's strange because meanwhile in the US, I mean, both the Xbox One and the PS4 are tracking above what their previous consoles did in the previous, you know, console generation. So
right. And that's going to be enough to keep a lot of Western developers afloat.
Yep.
And, you know, even through a period of high costs, but also much greater access and flexibility in the marketplace. And Japan has not kept up with any of that stuff.
Yeah.
And they, by narrowing the cultural focus of the majority of the output of games from Japan, you know, they've gone much more towards hardcore fanboys and fan service and otaku type shit that really was all what used to be kind of a niche of their market that was always there. But now it feels like that's most of the games that are coming out of Japan. And that stuff really doesn't fly everywhere else in the world. And so the market potential has greatly shrunk because they're not, their games aren't even, a lot of them don't even make that much sense to localize. Like maybe Atlus or Exceed does it and like this tiny group of people buy it. But it's not like that game's going to become a runaway hit in America or something like that, the way that things did back in the 80s and the 90s.
Right, the first that came out of Japan. Metal Gear Solid, you know, prime example.
I mean, kind of the shakeout here is that these huge game experiences are now only being made by the huge publishers, like Nintendo, like Square Enix. They're the only ones that can afford to make these huge games, ironically in Nintendo's case, but...
And sometimes they're still taking a bath on them. I mean, like, Dragon Age 3, like, we haven't heard... I don't think they've done a financial reporting yet on it, but... I mean, it didn't sell that well. I mean, it's kind of funny. We talk about the decreasing willingness to swallow these huge projects coming out of Japan, like the day after Xenoblade Chronicles X released in Japan, a game that Nintendo says is so big that they packed every little bit they could into the disc. So these games still exist, and there is potential here for that to be the big breakout hit, but Nintendo's doing that as a loss leader game. Their goal is to get... consoles in homes. They're not as concerned about this game being profitable. So even if they lose money on this game, they may feel like the iterative sales they get and the iterative game sales that come from the iterative console sales is enough to justify that loss. That's the kind of risk you can take as a platform holder. You can fund these games. You know,
that's why we need platform holders.
Right.
That's why we need the first party developers to be strong.
Right.
Because they can afford to make these riskier, big budget games.
The fear of if we completely move away from these sort of proprietary platforms is that there's nobody who has to take that risk anymore. Amazon's never going to spend, you know, $80 million developing a game for Amazon Fire TV. There's just no reason for them to do that. Ultimately, they're selling you this device as an all-in-one. I mean, the lean times are coming from Japan. Like, this is going to be a problem because you see these publishers now who have these licenses. You have Konami, you have Capcom, you have Sega that have dozens and dozens of these highly desirable B-level licenses. You know, I don't say that derisively. It's just not like this isn't my mascot character. These are our ones directly under it. And they're
valuable to us, to the people who like those games and who want to see those franchises be available and maybe even continue in some fashion. It means a lot to us.
They have tremendous sentimental value.
I like Rocket Knight Adventures a lot.
But in a world of, these mobile games where they cost very little to make, they're not being sold on license. They're just being sold on how addictive they are and how well they gouge you for money. Do these licenses still have the same kind of actual market value? Because ultimately...
No, and associating them with that kind of game generally lowers their...
Hey, Breath of Fire.
Their total value to the consumer base, in my opinion. And... this is a lot of business talk, but I do want to say that I try to be an optimist most of the time. And I'll say that, number one, what I'm hoping is that Konami will leave at least some kind of skeleton crew in charge of their gaming division. And that could lead to an interesting situation where they no longer have the resources to develop anything, like any new projects, but they have some budget and they have an interest in getting their games out there and trying to show some level of productivity to their big corporation that mostly thinks of gaming as a relic of the past. Maybe they get involved in doing stuff like virtual console releases and more PC releases, which they've actually been doing a lot lately because they're relatively cheap.
Like, that's the thing. They aren't gonna sit on these IPs, but I mean, you can tell that as a company, they're kind of like, well, console games are, you spend a ton of money, you really don't get bang for your buck. You invest a lot up front and kind of hope you make it back, maybe. But they're looking at stuff. They're looking to basically maximize the money that they put in and get a whole lot more money back, which is why they're doing smartphone games. So stuff like VC, you may actually see that stuff.
Catalog sales.
And get it back.
Exactly. Catalog sales and also farming these IPs out so that other people make them. So they just sit there and they rake the money in.
So what I think you will see going forward, and we've seen it now with Square Enix did it when they conglomerated Square Enix. They conglomerated Square Enix, Taito, Quest.
And then Eidos and Quest. Yeah.
They brought in these all these companies sort of conglomerated into one thing because ultimately that's how you sort of manage your costs. You've seen it with Tecmo Koei. You've seen it with Bandai Namco. You've seen it with Sega Atlas in a way. That may be the path that follows here, is that maybe Konami finds a partner at some point and they, you know, they lump in with them. And then that team is making games now. And then Konami can continue on to do their slot machine pachinko games for, I don't know, Bomberman.
Yeah, and, I mean, they could effectively just become almost like, you know, like you'll see companies buy companies mainly for patents. Well, you could see somebody buy Konami just for their IPs.
Honestly, I mean, I think Nintendo would be a good candidate for that. But the thing is, Konami isn't going bankrupt. It's just that one division that's doing so poorly. And I don't think it's a very Japanese-style thing to do in the business world is to, like, spin off a section of your company and sell it to someone else. I mean, Nintendo kind of did that with Rare, but that was also an international
And they
deal,
only partially owned Rare to begin with anyway.
Right, right. All they had to do was sell some stock.
Like I said, those licenses in general for a big media company are your most valuable asset. But as we've seen, the value of licenses decrease with the sort of the rise of things like, you know, Bubble Witch Saga or whatever. it has a direct impact on the valuation of your company. And ultimately, this is a situation where maybe those licenses have value, but maybe not enough value to make it worth selling when you can still make, you know, your Castlevania themed slot machine you're going to put in pachinko halls. It comes into a situation where Konami still wants these licenses probably because they can do something with them, but they're probably not valuable enough that they could get the money that they would feel like, oh, well, then you hell, I'll sell it for that number. What you may see, hopefully, is maybe publishers that do still have the money are willing to take on the cost of producing a game and license out the license. But Konami's got kind of a checkered history with that. Like I mentioned, the two Silent Hill games that weren't developed by Konami. And, you know, there's a risk there that you're putting the fate of a license in the hands of another company and you lose some ability to control the quality of the product they ultimately produce.
You know, the last time the video game industry crashed, Nintendo ended up kind of being the savior in a lot of ways. This time around, at least in Japan, they might actually be the lone survivor. I mean, I think they're the only Japanese game company right now that I think will be fine one way or the other. They might shrink a lot, you know, but I think they'll weather the storm. I think they're strong enough for that, and they're very smart.
Even if Nintendo's okay, they need third parties making games for their platform simply because that's a source of revenue for them. I mean, if these start to go away, but quite literally go away, then it hurts them from the sheer standpoint of they lose a revenue stream. Even if the games...
And there's nothing to bring back.
Right.
Right now, at least most of the third parties are still around in some form, and so Nintendo has a chance to win them back if they... to release the right kind of new platform or they change their policies.
But if
or whatever.
They're just gone, I mean, what do you do?
Yeah. And it Nintendo sucks. Might not even have the opportunity to buy up some of these companies, you know, to kind of hold on to that history and have access to all that content. Even though that might seem like a natural thing to do in our sort of carnivorous version of capitalism in America, I don't really see that going out that way in Japan.
It sucks because we see other companies that are not as far down this dark trail as Konami. You know, we talked about how Konami lost all its figureheads. I mean, you look at Capcom, they've got two left. Yeah. Really?
Yeah, so in summary, don't look for any console games from Konami.
Okay,
ever,
yeah,
again.
Damn straight. But let's move on because there's a lot of games to talk about. We kind of got off to a cold, hard news discussion.
Cold,
right
hard reality.
Bat. But now we're going to hear from Guillaume, who's been patiently waiting over there with all his amiibos.
Yeah, I've actually played some games, but unfortunately, like, I feel like I need to be like positive and a beat after this segment, but I didn't really love any of the games that I played. So, okay, so very quickly, I tried Amiibo Tap, and if you don't know how it works, you take an amiibo, you tap it once on the gamepad, and it saves a file on the amiibo so that you can't basically use it again to unlock a different game. It ties one virtual console game to that amiibo. And the franchise that the amiibo comes from doesn't matter. Like, I have a Luigi figure. I got Super Mario Brothers, the first one. But, you know, I could have gotten anything else. I could have gotten Kirby game. It doesn't matter. So now that I've tapped the amiibo on the gamepad, like, it's locked, like, I've got Super Mario Brothers when I play Amiibo tab. And
do you have to put that Amiibo, that same one, back on there every time you want to play that game that it unlocked?
Yep. And the way that it works, like, it's much less of a kind of an NES remix scheme than I thought. Really, all it does is that it takes a selection of scenes, they call them. Basically, like, it starts you at one point in the game, one specific point in the game, and you've got 3 minutes. So in the Super Mario Brothers, like, the number of scenes can vary depending on the game. In Super Mario Brothers, you've got 9. So you tap the amiibo once, and you get level 1-1. Tap it again at any time, you get 2-1, and 3-1, 4-1, etc. The ninth scene is 8-4. So, you know, it's not very imaginative. Like, I don't know how you could have been imaginative with this setup, but, you know, 9 scenes are really just like the first level of every world. And
well, NES Remix is a lot more imaginative than that.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I was reading Nintendo's review, Don Koopman's review of the game, and he didn't score it, but he was very positive about it. He was saying that he found his own fun, basically, in trying to, you know, get as far into the games as he could every time that he tapped a figurine. I don't think I'm gonna be spending much time that way. Like, it's a neat freebie if you already have figures. If you don't, definitely don't rush out to buy some, because that would be losing money anyway. You're not getting the complete game. You don't know which game you're getting, and you're paying, you know, $13 instead of the $5 or $8 that costs you to get a VC game.
So, see, this seems like it's made for really small children.
Yeah.
Like, kids who might want the amiibos just because they're toys and because daddy likes the character or whatever. But, you know, basically they're not using them for video games. But now there's this thing where you can kind of leave the kid alone with it, because it's not like the kid's going to be off buying a bunch of DLC and stuff. He's just, mm-hmm. you know, slamming these things on there, and maybe he plays it for a minute, and then maybe he doesn't like that one, and he can pick up whatever and just kind of slam it on there. And maybe it's a nice way to kind of expose a little kid to some of these retro games that they might not normally be that interested in.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure if Nintendo was really thinking about that. There's a border around the game at all times reminding you which game you're playing, and of course a very prominent eShop icon that you can click,
really?
Yeah, to go buy the game.
Ooh, insidious.
Yeah, so that's Amiibo Tap.
Maybe not so good for your babies, then.
Yeah.
They're going to smash the eShop button.
Also, I played a little game that came out, I think, this week, Heartbeaten. And I was looking at Don Koopman again playing this in one of his videos, and it was just so weird. It's one of these games that was developed, like, the idea came up like in a day, like one of those challenges where a team of developers just try to riff on a concept, you know,
game jam.
And so this game is a very WarioWare like in that you've got only a few seconds to react, and basically the setup is that you've got this guy, he meets a girl, and he's like, oh, you're everything to me. And she says, you're really not a good fit, you know, like, or I really don't like you that much, etc. And you get this message, like, stomp on his heart or chop his heart in pieces, stuff like that. And then you've got this mini game where you might have to tap on the touchscreen as fast as possible on a non-stylized heart, like, not, you know, a Valentine's Day heart, but really like a bloody heart, and you tap on it, and yeah, and you know, blood spurts out, and you're basically, you have to keep doing that over and over again until you're not fast enough for the timer, and then it gives you a high score, a score, and you're trying to, I don't know, get as high a score as possible to unlock more of these mini games. Like, I wish that the setup or the way that these mini games flowed were more WarioWare like, because that might be a little bit more interesting. As it is right now, it's very much like playing one WarioWare micro game over and over again, which is more or less interesting depending on which one you get. Like, tapping on the touchscreen, not really fun, and also kind of scary. You know, you don't want to break your screen Some of the mini games are a little bit more imaginative than others, but overall, there's only 15 of them.
So they all involve this realistic looking heart.
Yeah, pretty much.
And this is like more realistic than, say, like Trauma Center.
Well, no, okay, I said not stylized, but I just mean like non Valentine's Day heart. It's pixel art.
Pixel art.
Yeah, so it's not, you know, photorealistic or anything. Okay. It's not even Trauma Center, you know.
Yeah, I need smashing.
Mm-hmm. But I found the idea pretty cool. It was kind of fun to play through. I went through it maybe half an hour. It cost me $3 Canadian, so I don't know. It depends what your dollars are worth to you. I don't think I overpaid, but at the same time, I feel like most people could probably just look it up on YouTube, watch Dan's video and be satisfied. Or actually, this has been apparently available on iPhone and Android forever, so you could also check that out.
Yeah.
A third game that I've played, Demon's Crest 2. This I had never played before. I had played the Game Boy Gargoyles Quest, Demon's Crest. What am I even saying? Why is Demon's Crest written here?
Because you told me that.
Yeah, I'm sorry. So
I didn't catch it either. Gargoyles Quest 2.
Yeah. So I've been playing Gargoyles Quest 2. Really hard to pronounce. I had played the first one, on the Game Boy. I had played, of course, the Super Nintendo Demon's Crest, which was subtitled Gargoyles Quest 3 at some point. But yeah, I had never played the second one, and I'm kind of surprised at how much like the first Gargoyles Quest it is. Like, it's a weird sequel that came out on the NES after the first game came out on the Game Boy. And so I don't think there's any Game Boy version of Gargoyles Quest 2. I don't think there's an NES version of Gargoyles Quest 1. So it's kind of this semi-remake where the game mechanics are very, very similar. And overall, the progression is very, very similar. But I guess that on the NES version, you've got a bigger playing field. You see more where you're going. And it's just, you know, several little improvements like that you would get from upgrading from the Game Boy. I don't know. I don't have any strong feelings about it. Like, it was kind of cool. I recognized some enemies. I recognized some bosses that would go on to be upgraded in Demon's Crest. And the difference is really, stark, you know? And, overall, like, the game has this very cartoony look. It's not DuckTales, but close, you know, like very bright colors. You know, colors that the NES was capable of, but it's not even as dark as something like Castlevania, right? And then you jump to Demon's Crest, and very gothic, very dark, mm-hmm. very moody.
More like Castlevania 4.
Yeah, and if I had seen that transition today, I would have been probably very jaded about it. Like, oh, they got to make everything gritty. Gargoyle's Quest was so, you know, like cutesy and fun. But Demon's Crest is really awesome, so I can't critique it for that.
No, the artwork is especially awesome, I think.
It is. But yeah, like, it's a very short game. I'm glad I got the opportunity to play it at last. Just the fact that Capcom finally put this out on the Virtual Console, I think, so makes great. It worth checking out. Yeah, seriously, because I was going through... Yeah, I went to the Wii mode and went into the Wii shop and checked out the stuff that I got from Capcom on the Virtual Console. And I think I got like zero, or maybe I got Street Fighter. But that was about it, because Capcom went back over and over again, always releasing the same games. They mm-hmm. always released like these compilation discs, and the games that you would find there would be the same games that you would find on Virtual Console. So, you know, and usually they came out for $20 on the PlayStation 3, let's say, or 2. And then, you know, they asked for $5 per game at least on the Virtual Console. Like, I just never picked anything up. But if they had put these games that they never put in any compilation, then of course I would have spent my money on it. So I'm just glad that finally Capcom gave me that opportunity.
Yeah, they've actually been pretty good about it, if you think about it. I mean, all those Mega Man handheld games, You know, there for years they had tried to put that together as a collection for, I believe it was GBA.
Yeah.
And it was, it was more than a rumor. It existed.
Oh, yeah.
They just for whatever reason couldn't get it all the way out the door. And I'm sure it was a market potential thing. I mean, there's just probably not that many people who would be interested in buying something like that. And it's expensive to get a bunch of cartridges manufactured. But in this day and age, they can release them individually for next to nothing on the eShop.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people like me who always wanted to try those things can easily get them for a really good price.
Yep. So, thumbs up. One last game that I've been playing is the promised FPS game that I've played maybe like two missions of. I'm so sick of FPS games. I'm sorry. Technically, I guess it wasn't part of my backlog because it's a game that I borrowed for a past retroactive when we played GoldenEye multiplayer online before the demise of the GameSpy network. So I've tried playing the main missions, the main story mode, and what's the point? Why does this game exist? Like, I don't get it. Like,
whoa, this is getting existential.
No, but GoldenEye is the one first-person shooter that I've played on N64. Like, back when the N64 was new, my friends and I would rent the console, and rent this game at the same time, and we would play it. Like, we would go through the first few missions, we would unlock the paintball mode, and then we would go nuts with the multiplayer mode, and it was a ton of fun. This is only paying kind of lip service to any kind of memories that you could have of playing GoldenEye on the N64. It doesn't have, as far as I can tell, it doesn't have an unlockable paintball mode. It does have a big head mode that you unlock via inputting a code, but that's just sacrilegious, you know? And,
so picky.
Well, you know, like, I just don't understand it.
The N64 game had codes too, buddy.
Yeah. Well, in fact, there were whole areas locked behind codes.
Huh. So did Banjo-Kazooie. Rare was not above passwords, let me tell you.
Whatever. I miss paintball, I guess. But playing through the main missions, I just don't get it. Like, to me, the best James Bond game that's been made so far is Everything or Nothing. It was third person. There was a lot of stealth involved, a lot of hand-to-hand combat. Shooting was not a major part of that game. There was a lot of shooting, but mostly you were evading enemies or punching them. It just doesn't make sense. Like, I am playing GoldenEye, and you're supposed to be stealthy, so you're always crouching. And I guess you have to not let the enemies see you, and then if you shoot them before they raise the alarm, then they don't get reinforcements. But that's about the extent of the stealth elements that are in this game. And it's just stupid. Like, you'll shoot down a guard just walking around, you know, patrolling, and his body disappears, and then his buddy behind him walks over where his corpse would have been and, you know, probably sees like a discarded gun there on the floor and doesn't ring the alarm. Like, it's not a good stealth game. I guess that GoldenEye originally was not also a good stealth game, but
nope.
This was, you know, in the days before Metal Gear Solid had come out, right? So our expectations were a little bit lower. I think that they should have updated that part of GoldenEye or made it more of a run-and-gun game. Like, right now, it's this weird compromise that I just don't understand.
So I'll give you a couple things that'll help clear up how this game is what it is. First off, Activision, when they handed it over to Eurocom, also handed them the Call of Duty engine, which I think was the Call of Duty 4 engine. So for the Wii version, it would have been the Reflux Edition engine. And said, make a Bond game on this. So right. A lot of the gameplay stuff feels the way it does, ultimately, because this game is essentially a big, giant Call of Duty mod.
Right, right.
The other thing they did was they brought in a writer from one of the earlier Bond films to sort of modernize, because GoldenEye came out in 90, the movie came out in 97, I guess? 96?
96, but, I think, yeah.
But
the game was 97.
It feels so incredibly dated if you go watch it now. that they really had to kind of slick it up and kind of, and they moved it towards the presentation style of the modern Bonds, you know.
Right.
So you ended up with this weird adapting the sort of base story into the sexier Bond world of that we have now, which I know that was kind of a hard shift for Eurocom to make, because ultimately the premise of GoldenEye is there's a dude who's stealing a lot of money from banks, and also he has a satellite that really blows shit up. Mm. It's like it's kind of ham-fisted villain o'clock.
Yeah.
So they sort of had to make it work in this sort of more sophisticated Bond that they're currently trying to push out there. So there's like that scene in the club, which feels like every European dance club in every movie ever made.
That's where I stopped, actually.
Yep, because ultimately they're trying to give the impression of these of the current Bond films. So there's a lot of these places where they had you slow down and sort of put you in a place that you might see in one of these movies.
Right.
So, but they're doing that in an engine that is almost entirely built around being a run and gun first person shooter. So they had made these weird compromises that you see in the gameplay sometimes. I kind of give Eurocom credit for pulling it off, because they were sort of putting if they could build an engine from scratch, you could put much more emphasis on things like stealth and, you know, hand to hand combat. But ultimately, the engine they had didn't really support it. So it's sort of Activision being Activision here a little bit.
Right.
But, yeah. I'll still say I think the campaign in GoldenEye is about as much fun as any Call of Duty campaign, for my money.
But so, that's not and good. Eurocom is capable of better.
Different.
Yeah, but Eurocom is capable of better. Nightfire did develop that, right? That was an okay James Bond game. I remember enjoying that. Maybe I need to revisit it to be sure, but I'm pretty sure I enjoyed it more than this.
So Nightfire is kind of a weird game in and of itself, because ultimately it's just set pieces blowing up.
Sure.
I mean, but it was
good enough. It was more honest about being a first person.
Oh yeah,
shooter,
I mean, because you'd like shoot it and then be like slow mo zoom into the explosion.
Sounds like Black.
And get the.
By the way, I wanted to clear up that Activision added the paintball mode for the downloadable version for Xbox 360 and PS3.
Yeah,
GoldenEye Reloaded a couple years later, and apparently there was some controversy over it because for multiplayer, the paintball mode was exclusive to GameStop pre-orders.
Oh wow!
Although they did apparently add it as a single-player campaign option for everybody.
Okay, well that's shitty. But yeah, just to go through my list of grievances from this game, like the Wii Remote controls are not as good as the conduits. I never found a way to resize the bounding box, which is how far you can get the reticle close to the edge before the camera moves. And I wish I could have toyed with that, because it seems the camera moves way too quickly, or too early. And it kind of robs you of the advantage that you would have playing with the Wii Remote and just directly aiming. And
I'm almost positive there is an option for that in GoldenEye.
Maybe.
I don't know where in the menus you would
find
it. But
like, aiming down the sights doesn't seem to work all that well, not when you're using the Wii Remote. And then I switched. I went and I got my classic controller, and I just played as you would, you know, on any other console. And it was much better. Like, this game is very much designed. And, of course, like, they packed a golden classic controller with this game when it came out. There's a reason. They designed it for that. And the Wii Remote thing is just, you know, an afterthought. Anyway, that's enough crapping on this game, I'm sure. I just, one more thing.
Or maybe not.
You're trying
one
to...
One more turd.
Yeah, one more turd. Like, you're often high up in places, like on, I don't know, like in vents or stuff like that, and you're asked to aim down at enemies below, and you can't. The camera won't go down. Why prevent me from looking down? Like, maybe they were trying to avoid, like, an embarrassing situation where, oh, you can't see the character's feet, but I don't know. Haven't we moved on from that? Like, I thought that was like a 90s first-person shooter problem.
Nope.
I don't know what the reason is, but yeah, so you can't aim down. It just feels so constrictive. It's like when I talked about like the claustrophobia of Donkey Kong 64. Like, again, like here it kind of feels like you're playing someone with a intense neck pain. And it's not good. Like, if you're trying to foster understanding of people with a disability, cool, but this is a James Bond game.
Well, I wonder if that comes from the Call of Duty lineage.
It does kind of resemble an N64 game in some very intentional but very weird ways that you may not appreciate very much. A lot of people might not.
Nope.
But I do think that's kind of a weird throwback. It feels almost like a retro. It's like one foot in the old school and one foot in the new school.
It's kind of a demake. Yeah.
And it ends up feeling like a weird, awkward hybrid, which
it is. It's the never say never of the video game James Bond world.
There you go.
That pale clone of something much better.
I think you're being very harsh because I think that game is rad. But
I'm just tired of shooting dudes. I'm sorry.
Well, no one's... Is anyone even no one asking forced me. You to?
Definitely I know, no I know. You to. As
John's
I said a month
out,
ago,
so no.
yeah. As I said a month ago, I just trolled myself, really.
Yeah. NFL draft is pretty interesting.
Oh, my God.
Oh, man.
Picks John.
I bet a lot of those football players have some wild arms.
I'm out of here.
Speaking of which.
You do that transition over again. I'm not going into that. James is
hey,
up
James.
Next. Hey, thanks, Johnny. So, about a month ago, maybe a little bit more, Sony did this weird deep cut flash sale on the PSN, and John and I were doing Now Playing when I was going through it, and we sort of cross-encouraged each other to buy games that we have no chance of ever actually playing.
Yeah, but like 15 games for $10 kind of thing.
Yeah, just something stupid and insane like that.
Tokyo Jungle! Oh, dude, get it!
I want to be a Pomeranian! So, yes, we both bought Tokyo Jungle, I think. So, that's not what I'm talking about, though. I actually decided I was going to go play Wild Arms, which is one of the games I bought. I actually bought it and its sequel. And the reason I was kind of interested in playing this game is sort of what we were talking about earlier. The fact that these kind of big JRPGs, just traditional JRPGs, aren't really getting broadly made right now.
Mm-hmm.
And
you should explain what Wild Arms is.
It is a Super Nintendo JRPG on the PlayStation. That is what Wild Arms is.
Yeah, pretty much.
And like,
was it ever released for Super Nintendo?
It was a Sony funded adventure, but it is
okay. So it was made specifically for PlayStation,
right? It's just that it uses sprites. It came before Final Fantasy VII.
Well,
right?
I want to talk about that. So Wild Arms came out 41 days before Final Fantasy VII.
Just in time.
And let me tell you, it feels like 41 years.
Yeah.
So,
yep.
Wild Arms is like, so it is a very, very traditional Super Nintendo era JRPG. I mean, mm-hmm. it looks like a sharper Super Nintendo game with a little bit more color. There's some video in the front of it that runs at about 12 frames a second. It uses sprites that look, you know, roughly commensurate, a little bit sharper with some of the higher end sprites from Super Nintendo games, a little bit bigger. The world is sort of the 2D isometric, you know, three quarters angle that you're used to from games of that era.
Yeah, Suikoden looks a little bit like that too.
A little bit, yeah.
I played that fairly recently on my Vita.
A little bit. The biggest differentiating factor here between it and Super Nintendo games is that when you get into battle, you get polygonal models that are super deformed. Probably more as a crutch than it is as of a design conceit. It's an interesting enough game. You know, there's a bunch of systems that they don't bother explaining in true RPG styles of that era. So I'm trying to figure out, like, what items do. I'll give you a great example. There's an item that, when I found the button that tells you what an item does, which was a nice find, it says revives from the dead or something like that. I was like, okay, that's good to have. And it gave me three of them right before a boss battle. I went, oh no, that's probably not good. And the boss has an insta-kill. So I turned around and said, okay, I'm going to use it to revive my two guys that went down. There's no way I could beat this boss with one character. And I can't use it. What? So I thought maybe I have to use it outside of battle. So I ran around and did the overly frequent random battles, because again, of the era, and just let a character get killed so I could use the item. No dice. So this is getting kind of weird now. What do I do? Because the character is
do I use items?
Yeah, because the character revives after every battle. So I'm like, well, that doesn't help. It turns out you have to equip this stupid thing. The sacrificial goat is the name of the item. Or no, goat doll. You have to equip this item in the character's left hand, and then when they die, it is expended, and they wake up.
oh, it's a fairy in a bottle in Zelda.
Yeah, but again, because it is of this era, this super limited text, limited exposition, no explanations. Good luck figuring this crap out.
That was still a problem in FF7, actually, even though it sounds very advanced compared to Wild Arms.
Oh, yeah.
But it was a huge problem before FF7. FF7 was like the first JRPG that I can remember that allowed the game text system to use more than six letters for a character's name.
Oh, yeah. And I'll tell you...
That's why Kefka is named Kefka and not Sephiroth. Because Sephiroth wouldn't have fit in the text bubbles on Super Nintendo. I mean, that was a kind of weird step change in technology that we were seeing back then.
And part of that is just because they were more aware of the fact that game is going to be released outside of Japan. Because that game cost so much money, it had to be.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Led to the golden age, didn't
Wild it? Wild Arms did not cost that kind of money.
No.
So, I will say, like, it's of the Super Nintendo era in almost every single way, because like the translation is atrocious.
I played this all the way through back in the day. I don't remember shit.
Did you really, John?
I did. That was back when I used to actually beat games. Yeah, it was cool.
Like this was also in the era of very poor Sony localization.
Oh yeah. There's these monsters,
including FF7.
This was a very early Sony game for the PS1.
'96.
And I mean, it was really early, and really there wasn't a whole lot else out there RPG wise at the time on the console, which is why I bought it.
There was Beyond the Beyond.
Oh. I don't even remember.
So
that's a Camelot joint. That's from the makers of Golden Sun.
Oh man,
I believe that was actually their previous RPG before Golden Sun was the rather notorious Beyond the Beyond, mm-hmm. which. It even looks a lot like Golden Sun, actually.
A little bit.
Does not have a good reputation.
I'll give you a great example. So a lot of the aliens, there's these aliens that are, although the story doesn't really tell you this until about five or six hours. So first off, I want to congratulate this
game. Aren't you a cowboy? Isn't this like a Western?
It's not really set
in the desert, and the music is inspired by spaghetti Westerns, but not really. It's humans versus demons, but the demons are actually space aliens, but they don't come out and say it. They just sort of say, when we arrived on this world, it's like, wait, what? Oh, back up.
Yeah, and
are you aliens?
It's very typical. You have like, you know, the kind of the wise cracking girl, the hero kind of boy.
No. She's super proper. She's the super proper princess.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah. So, but of course you have the fat kid who's always getting in, you know, always screwing something up.
Oh, you're thinking of two, John. Did you play Four Arms
too? I don't know, man.
Jesus!
I'm mixing cliches here.
So, this one has a three-character model, and there's one thing I actually like about it is you pick the character you want to start at, but you play as all three of them. And a lot of times they'll separate them and give you different bits of their history individually, and you have to kind of learn to play with them on their own. Each character has a set of items they can use to solve basic puzzles, kind of in a... Imagine like the rings you get in a Tales game, but there's a lot more items, so there's more diversity in it. And some characters will interact with you differently based on who you're in control of at that moment. But yeah, you have your guy out for revenge that he's keeping to himself a bit, and he joined the party simply because it's going to give him a chance to get power. You have the teenage boy who's just out looking for adventure, and then you have the princess who is prim and proper, not to save the world. Like it's there's not a lot of interaction between them because there's not a lot of interaction in general because the story just doesn't care. But I did want to touch a little bit on the translations with these aliens / demons / whatever the game feels like calling them that day.
Make it quick.
So to give you an idea of what we're dealing with here, they did they replaced all the R's with L's when they translated it into English. So there's a character named Berserk, but in the English one, he's Belzlik. Because Sony couldn't even figure this shit out on their own. This is like, I just wanted to mention that one because it makes me laugh every time he comes up on screen. I just lose it. It's
terrible.
But in and of itself, though, the game is kind of amazing that it came out so close to Final Fantasy VII with all its pre-rendered background art. So this is just Super Nintendo sprites on Super Nintendo sprite worlds. I'm enjoying it. I've also broken it with this item duplication glitch because I just want to get through the battles quickly because there's so many of them. So I've max statted everybody. I'm just running through battles at this point. But it's an interesting game if you're if you sort of remember the Super Nintendo era of RPGs, you kind of want to experience one that's kind of in the middle of the road of quality there. Mm. It's like, I haven't done one in a while, and I would like to try one I probably haven't played, because you probably didn't play this one.
No, you probably didn't. And I'm curious, but like, if let's say if you also haven't yet played Breath of Fire.
Oh, Breath of Fire. Yeah, of course. But
you should go that with that and over Wild Arms.
Well, remember, Breath of Fire was a Square game.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, yeah, it's good.
Mean, yeah, it's a really good game. And Square put money in. This is a Media Vision game. That should be your that should tell you what you're getting into.
So this is not a must play for Super Nintendo RPG fans.
No, but if you want to try one, like if you have if you're just like sure, and it's on sale again for like $1.50, like it was. Like it,
man, the 3D graphics in this game are hysterical.
Oh, they're terrible.
Why did you do that?
Like a 15-hour game. I mean, you can beat it pretty quick. And
Now that is unusual, actually.
It's got some there's some stuff in there that's okay, and you know the characters aren't bad. They don't talk much because they couldn't be bothered, but it does sometimes feel like maybe they cut some text out of the localization because they just couldn't be bothered. But if you want to play a game made by the producers who made Sneakers, then yeah, congratulations. Wild Arms is for you. Or maybe it's sequel, Wild Arms 2. I do like that they remade the game, though, on the PS2, and when they went to localize it, fans of this game pressured them into keeping the mistranslated names.
Ooh.
It's just great. Great. That sounds like a terrible.
But I mean, the thing is, if you don't
like, I bet they regret that decision.
The thing is, though, if you don't like Wild Arms 1 or 2, there's also 3, 4, and 5 too.
It's true, or an XF on the PSP.
Yeah, I mean, you got options, is what we're saying.
Or Alter Code F, which is a remake of 1. If you want to give it another shot.
Okay. I don't have many options because I've got a lot of games to talk about and not much time to do it. So. I will briefly say that, as I hinted last week, Mr. TYP, Michael Cole, and his lovely wife stayed the weekend with me, and we didn't play that many games, honestly, but we did get in some time on Mario Kart 8, and we got to both try the DLC for the first time, because it came out basically the night before he had to come and drive over to visit me. So, we had a really good time with this DLC, and I know we talked about it briefly last week. I just wanted to add that I really like it so far. I'm very, very pleased, very impressed with both of these packs, and especially for the value that you get. I think it is, even among Nintendo's other DLC experiments, this is by far the best value of any that I've seen. And I think they're clearly putting a ton of work into these tracks, and the new characters, and, you know, even the new 200cc mode, I barely tried it. TYP wasn't that interested, and so I tried a little bit of Grand Prix for myself, but actually I had to unlock it because apparently I never unlocked mirror mode the first time around or when I was playing the original DLC. So I went back and like very easily got through those cups that I didn't yet have gold. I don't know if it's that I'm using better parts in my cart or one of the new characters. I can't remember which one. But might have been Villager. But anyway, I blew through those. They seemed really easy to me, and I remember having a little bit of trouble on the special cup. But anyway, so I unlocked Mirror Mode, which also unlocks 200cc. Those just basically come together now as a package. And 200cc seemed way over my head, but funny. And I could see if it's especially in multiplayer or something, if you're not too worried about trying to win every single race against the computer who now almost break the physics to get around some of those curves at the speed that they do. I suspect that you're better off sort of competing with your friends or just trying to stay alive and not fall off the track because it's real wacky and it feels a little bit broken, but I love that it's free for everybody. And I love that they went there. I think they looked at it and said, well, we can do it and it won't crash the game. So we got nothing to lose, and that's awesome.
I've played the first few cups on 200cc. To me, it's kind of a little bit easier than 150. I think that the AI maybe can't really cope with the extra speed, and so it's just a little bit easier to beat them or to not have the one AI character always win everything. So overall, it's easier to get ahead in points.
Right.
I also think you're a lot better than I am at Mario Kart. And you might have a much better setup of the vehicle parts than I do.
Yeah, I don't know. I just grabbed Isabelle, and she's really good with her buggy, which is an actual bug. It's awesome. Try playing as her. Yeah.
We'll I mean, my time with it kind of mirrors Guillaume, because it always feels like there's one person who's always going to get first place unless you beat them, and then they get second. So if you slip one race, you lose in 150. Like, you almost have to get first or second every single race. In 200, it's just a free for all.
Yep.
It's just chaos, and because chaos reigns.
If you're more consistent than everyone else, then you'll end up winning.
Right.
I think so. It's a little bit like F-Zero GX that way. No.
Yeah, I can see that, because in F-Zero GX, especially in the higher difficulties, it was...
And there's 30 cars on the track.
Yeah, it was just basically survive and you win.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yep. I remember some of that. So, James, I know now you mentioned that you had played some of 200cc, but you have not paid for the DLC.
I have not.
Are you tempted? Is there anything in particular that's keeping you? I mean, I would recommend it.
James, you bought Wappy Dog.
I did. John,
Jesus
Wappy,
Christ.
Wappy Dog, Wappy Dog, was, Wappy Dog was cheaper than the Mario Kart DLC.
Oh, man.
And my Amazon Prime doesn't help me with the DLC. It's just I don't play this game very much. Like, I had to unlock 200 mode because I didn't have it.
Yeah, I don't have it unlocked either. So
and
I got to get on
it's
that.
It's just... I have so few opportunities to play the game. It just doesn't seem like a strong economic proposition when I've got Wild Arms 2 waiting for me. But
well, James, perhaps you and I can play on Wiggler Wednesday.
Is that very carefully. Is that what it is? John? That's not what
it's
I thought Wednesday
Wiggler,
was.
Wiggler Wednesday.
Okay. Yeah. I see. Okay.
Yeah. Be careful when you're spelling that one, kids. Anyway, that sounds perfectly understandable. Yeah, I mean, if you're not playing Mario Kart, if you don't really want to be playing a lot more Mario Kart, then the DLC is $12 that you could spend on other things. I think if you want to play more Mario Kart, then the DLC is absolutely worth the price. And I think they've done a stellar job with it. And I, for one, would really be happy if they just announced a couple more packs coming later this year. Like one for late summer and one for right before Christmas or something like that. Yeah. I'd be thrilled. I'd be happy to pay another $12 and get even more, you know, 16 more tracks, or maybe even they do one that's all battle mode stuff and they actually like add battle mode arenas and some kind of sensible damn rules and make a fun battle mode and just be like, yo, you wanted it. Pay $10. Here it is. And it's great.
Yeah.
Everybody would be fucking thrilled.
You'd have to add more characters with it, but yeah.
More, there's already so many characters.
Yeah, I know, but like,
what if they just added some battle, like battle specific items that you could
maybe
unlock,
but like,
you know,
like imagine
put spikes on your cart or whatever.
Imagine if you have Captain Falcon's model sitting in a tiny cart, like the little baby stroller cart. Like, imagine that. That's what I want.
You want baby Captain Falcon?
No, I want adult Captain Falcon riding in baby Peach's cart.
Use your Mii and use the Captain Falcon amiibo that everyone has.
No, I want him to be big and burly, like bigger than a Mii. I want him to just look ridiculous.
Unfortunately, I don't think adding a double dash mode is really practical, because these graphics models are so complicated that I think, you know, building carts that you could fit both of them in there and then syncing up their animations or whatever is probably such a big job that it'll just have to become the basis of Mario Kart 9. But I digress.
11.
Let's talk briefly about Geometry Wars 3, which I've mentioned before here on the show, even though it is not available on Wii U, which is a tragic crime. Geometry Wars 3 is amazing, and I love it dearly. And I guess I love what playing this game more and more, and it just continues to delight me. And they've added a ton of stuff. They just did this massive free patch where they added an entire other campaign. They basically doubled the amount of campaign content, and they added an additional mode in the I think they added the original Geometry Wars to the arcade mode that's kind of set up for leaderboards. And they also did something with the two-player online mode, I think, which I never mess around with. Anyway, they added a new clone, a new whatever that little, you know, your option dude that follows you around, a drone, that's what they call it, and a new superpower. So they added just all this crazy stuff for free if you already own the game. And it's still, I think, $15, and it's now a much, much larger game than it was before. And it was already a pretty meaty thing. But, I mean, this is coming from a guy who played probably 100 hours of Geometry Wars Galaxies on the Wii. So I guess I like Geometry Wars more than other people do.
Is probably
kind of what I'm gathering, because nobody's talking about this game and it's really great. I think it's very clearly the best Geometry Wars. And if people are saying, well, it didn't stick with me, I just didn't enjoy it as much, I think that's because not enough people are playing it. So they didn't get that competitive spirit that they used to have in Geometry Wars 1 and 2. And that's not the game's fault. So
I think you're just better at it than most people, probably, so you enjoy it more.
You know, I've been thinking about that too, because I would say generally I'm not that great at video games, but I feel like when I play this game, I feel kind of like I've played it so much, and not because I ever sat down to get really good at Geometry Wars. It's just that I got so addicted to it a few years ago between Galaxies and then 2 coming right after it. There was like probably over a year where I played Geometry Wars at least 5 days a week.
Yeah.
So I played a shitload of it because I was just could not stop playing it. And I think I got pretty good at it, and maybe that's part of it.
You just seem to get it. You know, I mean, like, I'd get like 7 million points or something, and you'd be like, ha-ha, cool, dude, I got like 14 million. Anyways, and I'd just be like, all right, okay, all right. And you'd be like, it's yeah, practice. Do this, and do that, and
I
do
mean,
that.
I'll play a stage in that game several times in a row.
Yeah.
Like, if it's not going well, you know, if I die too early in the 3-minute run, I know that that's going to screw up my combo, and so I just immediately restart.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not a perfectionist, but I expect to score well in those stages. And if I just scrape by, especially if I'm actually trying to compete with my friends, you know, I will just go after it over and over and over and over again. And to me, like, navigating the little intricacies of that game are so fun. And there's so many new ones in this game. I mean, last night in the new campaign, I played a stage. It was in a mode called Titan, which actually they introduced in Galaxies on the Wii, which you should only play with a classic controller, in my opinion. But anyway, there's this Titan mode where you start out with a bunch of like giant-sized versions of the familiar enemies, and they're just kind of floating around. And when you shoot them, they break up into smaller ones. So it's like asteroids, you know, when the asteroids would break up into smaller chunks and smaller chunks. So the pieces are smaller and in some ways less threatening as you continue to shoot them, but also they multiply, and so there's just more and more and more, and they're just kind of exponentially expanding as you spray your shots all over the place or use a super weapon. And so it can become really crazy really fast if you're not careful. You kind of want to take it very meticulously. But this version of the level in the new campaign was all snakes. If you know those red snakes with the blue head, and you can only kill them by shooting them in the head, and they move in these really unpredictable patterns, and they completely drive you crazy when they get all intertwined up into each other, so the tail of one ends up shielding the head of the other, and they're really a nightmare. And so now I'm surrounded by the giant version of that, which is a brand new model that they just created just for the patch for this game. It's not even in the main game, which I played all of. And I'm just thinking, this is so cool. This is, and it's completely challenging and scary and ridiculous in a different way than any other version of that mode or any other level in the game. And I've played like 4 or 5 of these Geometry Wars games now, and they're still adding really cool little wrinkles like that that make me go, man, these guys really love this stuff, and they really love thinking of these crazy new things. And again, I'm just a huge fan. Geometry Wars 3, in particular, is a game that a lot of people never thought would come out because the original developer kind of got disbanded by Microsoft, and then Activision held on to the license, didn't do anything with it for a few years, and then all of a sudden, under this new Sierra-like sub-brand of Activision that's also doing the new King's Quest, they announced that, hey, lo and behold, there's a third Geometry Wars game, and everybody was like, but it looks weird, and I don't know if I still want to play Geometry Wars in 2014 or 2015. And I'm like, oh, I do.
Bring oh, yeah, up. Dude.
Right here, in my mouth. Right here. So, yeah, I love it, man. No one talks about this game. I don't
yeah,
understand
it. Yeah, it
kind of
came and went.
It's
came
so
and
fantastic.
Went. Yeah.
And it just keeps you know, giving and giving. I mean, it's really kind of like Resogun in that way. I still pick up Resogun every few weeks, and it feels like every time I turn it on, there's new shit in it.
Yeah.
And I've kind of like fall in love with it all over again and play it a lot for like 2 or 3 days before I end up, you know, getting pulled away by something else. But I mean, that game just never gets old for me.
Yep.
I love both of these. And I guess the pleasant surprise for me is actually like Geometry Wars 3 really just as much as Rezogun.
Yeah, they're great games.
And it's turned out to be one of my most played games on PS4. It's also on PC, which is nice, which I think none of the other ones have been in the past. So it's nice that more people can play that. It's on Xbox, of course, but it's not on Wii U, and that's a bummer. It would run fine. It would look great. It'd be perfect. That just sucks. All right. Well, finally, wrapping up the segment, I want to give a quick plug, and I mean, not just a plug. This is part of my new business. I spent a pretty good amount of time this week participating in and then watching the Nintendo World Report Smash Brothers tournament that's been going on for a while. And we've talked about it here and there, but I really like sat down for about an hour last night just watching the videos from the first round of playoffs. And I've been watching these kind of sporadically, sometimes mostly just to kind of prepare for whoever we're facing off the next week. But this was the first week where I think I watched all of the videos, because there's only four, you know, now that we're in the playoffs. There were 8 teams in the first round, 4 matches. Each one's, you know, between 10 and 20 minutes long, basically, each video. And they are so much fun to watch. Even the teams that I don't really know that well, I don't know the people that are on the team quite as well. I don't understand their fighting style or what's going into it. I really enjoyed these videos so much. And I wanted to commend Neil and Scott for not only for putting this together, because when they first pitched this idea, I think it's one of those things that sounds so cool and it'll never happen. You know, you get this all the time on the website because there's a staff of all these creative people. A lot of people have much bigger ideas than they actually have the level of skill or commitment to put together a really complicated feature article or something like that. So you see a lot of ideas pitched around that never come to fruition, right? It's a writer's room. This is what happens. It's part of the natural order of this thing going forward. But this is one of those ideas that I really couldn't believe when they actually like booked us to play a match. I just thought, man, I can't believe we're actually going to do this.
Yeah.
And it has been delightful from start to finish. We have had so much fun. We've put so much planning into it, so much thought into how we're going to do it. You know, I was not a team sports kid, so getting involved in soccer and baseball I didn't have a lot of good experiences with those things, but this felt like actually we were getting together at least once a week to practice and to play the matches, and we're talking about it after every week recording this show. We stick around for another hour to kind of put together a little bit of strategy, talk about how the other guys are doing, how we're going to be prepared for the match coming up. It has been almost like a sport to me, at least in that team dynamic. And it's been competitive, but not that competitive. Like, it's been very friendly, very goofy. And I think the commentary by Neil and Scott, who are also organizing all this, doing the videos and everything, but their commentary is especially good. And it really ties together this whole thing because they know all of us. They get our personalities. They get all the different fighting styles. They get all the different levels and items and characters that are showing up here. Like, they know all of this stuff, but they're not like Smash Brothers grognard people. Like, this is a Smash Brothers tournament that you can watch and actually understand what people are talking about when they're explaining the match. Like, speak in plain English. They're just Nintendo fans. They understand all the elements, but they're not, mired in the minutiae of like hardcore world-class tournament level Smash Brothers, because they don't need to be, because none of us are that good, right? And the variety that you see in the matches, because these very clever rules that they set up about home team and away team, getting to choose the level, choose the items, everyone's choosing different characters because, you know, most of us aren't good enough to have mastered the crazy Diddy and Star Fox stuff. And so I played a match as Peach and one as Ness and one as Samus and Mega Man, and it's all over the place. Don played through the entire tournament as Dark Pit. There was copious Sonic and Shulk, and it is a Smash Brothers tournament really like no other that you'll find on YouTube. It if you guys, James, I bet you remember this, on Giant Bomb a few years ago, they did the Mortal Kombat 8 Scrub League.
Yeah.
And they put together, it's a very similar idea. It's easier for them with a studio. It's not nearly as complicated to organize everything. But they put together this dumb little tournament bracket of just the people on their staff playing Mortal Kombat. And a lot of them, the match that they recorded and is part of the video feature was the first time they'd ever played the game. So they're like fumbling with the we're more prepared than that, basically. But it's a bunch of amateurs, and some of the people are really good, and a lot of them are not that good, and they face off against each other. But because of all the crazy, you know, X factors throughout Smash Brothers, sometimes you get surprising little results and hilarious little things happen. So it's very dramatic, and Neil and Scott really, they get the sports drama of it. It's maybe more like sports entertainment is probably a better word for it. But they get all the team dynamics and the character choices, and they crack up at the goofy taunts, and it is truly entertaining, and I'm so impressed by our staff for coming together and doing such a big feature. And I think as a video feature, it's the best thing we've ever done. And I mean, it's as expansive, it's really more expansive than what we did, for instance, for RFN 400. And I don't know how many people, you know, we were live doing some of that live too on Twitch. And I don't know how many people ever watch that stuff. You know, the YouTube numbers aren't crazy or anything, but it's a big archive of stuff on our YouTube channel that you can go find if you search for RFN 400. And it's us playing games and talking about them. And it's really fun. Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of hilarious. The Smash Brothers tournament, I think is even better than that. I don't think you have to be really into Smash Brothers to enjoy it at all. I think if you just like Nintendo and you like funny stuff, you'll have a good time. So I really just wanted to give it that recommendation and try to push people to really go check this out, because this is not something that you should at all be intimidated by. I think you actually, if you like listening to this show, I think you will have a really good time listening to those guys talk about Smash Brothers and comment on those matches that some of us, as we're playing, I mean, some of us played against Greg Leahy in Smash Brothers last weekend.
Yep.
And there's a video of that, and there's people, well, by the time you hear this, yeah, that video will be out, and you'll be able to hear all the commentary for it. And those guys completely understand the built-in drama of Greg versus Team RFN and all that stuff. They totally get it. It's hilarious.
To give you an idea of what we were doing, I wrote Greg an email in the lead up to this, A, baiting him to play my trap rule set, and B, basically telling him that in the name of brotherhood, he really has to throw his match.
Yeah, you threw down the gauntlet.
Well, sort of.
Yeah, I mean, he's beyond the pale now as far as I'm concerned.
He's not part of us anymore.
Nope. Nope, he's gone.
I gotta say, there's a reason why I stayed away from this tournament. I get compared enough to Greg that I don't need this. Well, I don't need to fully, go toe-to-toe.
You're fully in the circle of trust now, buddy. Come here. That's give me right. a hug. Greg,
Greg's now exiled to the League of Honor Wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. All right, well, anyway, I'm going to wrap up the segment on that note. We're going to take a quick break. Stick around. We'll be back with the Thunder Round.
It's now playing a sampling of the best new original content at NintendoWorldReport.com. First up this week, we have a review of Amiibo Tap on Wii U by Don Koopman. Don finally gives up and stops scoring his reviews altogether. It's probably a wise decision. This time he takes a look at Amiibo Tap, the Wii U app that lets you unlock pieces of games, much like each Amiibo only unlocks an ethereal piece of happiness you so desperately seek.
Amen.
That's dark. That's real dark.
It's dark. It's Amiibo. Amiibo's
it's
a dark, man.
It's dark in here. It's dark, dark in the subject, heart of an Amiibo warrior. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go cry, and then I'm going to go look at the empty shelf space where my Shulk Amiibo should be.
Yep.
We also have a feature. A look back at Nintendo's 2005 show by Neil Ronahan. Ah, 2005. An awkward year. The GameCube and GBA were dying. The DS had just been born, and the Wii was still in the womb. The Circle of Life was on full display at E3. Well, that and Twilight Princess for the first time. Hop in the Wayback Machine and let Neil be your guide.
It's a circle. Circle
that game was at so many fucking E3s, it should have had its own booth.
Mm-hmm. All right, and we have a review of the Angry Video Game Nerd Adventures for Wii U by Brian Rose. If you want a challenge, Brian's here to tell you that Angry Video Game Nerd Adventures is for you. Sounds like it's also for you if you like four-letter words and poop jokes.
Who doesn't?
Excuse me, I have a new title to add to the backlog.
There you go.
And we have a preview of Puzzle & Dragon Z, or Zed, as they say it in the King's English, for 3DS by Don Koopman. Don follows up on his hands-on look at the Super Mario mode of his title with his thoughts on the Puzzle & Dragons mode. I'm sure James will be playing that religiously. See what sets the OG version apart from the new school version of his with his preview. That's it. No Kusage jokes here. Maybe next week we'll see what Don has in the pipeline. I'm sure he won't disappoint.
I will say, John, when you move to this country, we do not allow use of Zed in that context. We fought a war over that explicitly.
Well, you know what? Canada burned down the White House, buddy, so
it's true.
Don't make us do it again.
We burned down a whole fucking city.
You know, it's cool. Things are cool now.
We torched the whole city, John. Just look at that city and said, nah, this doesn't need to be here. Just level it. That's how we roll. All this and biting criticism on the use of force in other countries. It's available to you at NintendoWorldReport.com.
I'll die for Zed.
Welcome back, everyone. It is time for the Listener Mail Thunder Round.
Thunder Round.
Right here on Radio Free Nintendo. The address, as always, is rfn@NintendoWorldReport.com.
It's yay, Thunder Round. I like a Thunder Round. Yay!
Yay, Thunder Round. James is happy. Okay, John, could you read the first email, please?
Absolutely. Anthony writes, over the past 4 months, the amount of virtual console platforms on Wii U has doubled. Name one game from either the DS, Wii, or N64 you would buy day one if it were made available to download.
Well, if we're going to shoot for the moon, I say Saga 2, which was never localized, so it's a long shot. A very long shot. That was on the DS. It was a remake of Final Fantasy Legend 2, basically. And I've tried to get it to work, to get a ROM and a patch to work on the DS emulator, both on my computer and on the Wii, a hacked Wii, and never could do it. So legality is my only option.
And we're assuming that the games would show up on the platform that is currently supported.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So if you name a DS game, you're imagining playing it on your Wii U.
Okay, fair enough.
I don't know if any that I can think of would really qualify as something I would like immediately buy in that regard, because I'd have some reservations.
Blast Corps for me.
Ooh, I like a lot.
I'm actually going to go Mega Man 64 because I haven't played the game in a long time.
I would say Superman 64 as well.
Shut
Thanks,
up.
I would actually probably buy that.
It's true.
You probably would. I think a lot of people would, which is really sad. That's kind of like when TMNT for NES came out, and it was even like $6 instead of the usual $5. Oh. Speaking of Konami. Anyway, I'm having a hard time thinking of one that I would like freak out over.
That's a fair answer if you can't think of one.
I mean, the thing is, the DS is compromised by the fact that you're not playing it on a console.
I would say just ignore the DS.
Yeah.
Just go for it.
I mean, for the DS, I mean,
Wii games, I have almost anything I ever could have wanted.
Yeah, I was in the same spot.
I mean,
my involvement with the site. And N64, there aren't too many that didn't already come out on Wii Virtual Console.
Tetrasphere? No.
That's a good one.
Yeah. And unlikely to come out just because of the Tetris name.
Excitebike 64, I think, is damn good.
Yeah, it is.
And never came out on Wii for some reason.
There you go.
So that's a pretty decent one, I guess.
Dan writes, hey guys, what are your guesses for upcoming VC releases? I'm thinking in terms of N64, DS, or even digital Wii games. Thanks, and love the show. Dan, and shout out to Canada.
All of Canada.
The whole country.
America's, hey, Canada. America's hat.
Except Saskatchewan. Fuck those guys.
This show is half Canadian.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing that Nintendo is going to keep releasing Nintendo 64 games that were already released on the Wii.
Yep.
That's my guess. Like, I'm not expecting, like, Rogue Squadron or Shadows of the Empire or...
Oh, that's the one, actually.
That's your guess, or that's what you wanted?
That would be the one I would buy immediately. Yeah. Which, you know, that it could happen. I mean, if you look at all this Star Wars stuff just came out on PlayStation, they're adding a ton of stuff to Steam. Somebody at LucasArts kind of woke up and said, hey, we've got these old games. So,
yeah.
It's not out of the realm of possibility, but I don't know if it's happening anytime soon.
I think more likely they would bring the Super Star Wars series from Super Nintendo forward to Wii U, because that was already on Wii.
Yeah. And those games haven't
held
up. That
would be kind of the easy pickings.
Yeah.
Not as much.
I agree with Guillaume. It's going to be stuff that's already been out on Wii. So if we're going to talk about the Wii games then, because obviously those were out on Wii, but not in this form, I would guess that you're going to see North America is going to continue to be held slow for whatever reason. So just watch Europe go forward 2 months in time, and that's kind of what we're going to end up with. It looks like, though, that in Europe and Japan, they're kind of pulling from some weird places in the Wii's library, like Sin and Punishment Star Successor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I would say continue to see stuff like that. Maybe games they published late in the console's life cycle, like a certain game made by a certain Mistwalker that we talked about on the show.
Yeah, The Last Story.
That would be good.
Of course.
That'd be stuff awesome. Like that. Stuff that came out super late, and maybe they can get a little bit of a secondary wind on, especially games that came out in North America and Europe even later, like that and Pandora's Tower.
Yeah, which Xenoblade would be the perfect candidate, except the 3DS version is definitely going to make it a long time before that happens.
Yeah, would want to cannibalize that guy.
Yeah.
John?
Nah, I got nothing.
Cool.
I mean,
keep moving on.
The likely stuff, you know, Super Mario Galaxy.
Yeah, the big games.
That's very obvious. You know, new Super Mario Brothers for Wii.
My hope is really...
highly likely.
The Pikmin games, the new Play Control games. Come on.
Oh, that'd be nice.
I've been starred for more Pikmin for the past year.
Yeah, that'd be a really good one. DS stuff, I don't understand. I don't know that they're putting that much tactical thought behind the DS game so far. I mean, when the first couple of games you release for that platform kind of don't work, you know, like Yoshi's Island DS.
Yeah.
There's not really a way to display that on the Wii U that makes that game, like, natural to play.
Right.
So, just because you got it to run and you think people like Yoshi doesn't make it a good idea to just put that on a system that's not well-equipped, really, to support what it does with the two screens.
I would say it's a bad idea for us to try to predict intrinsically irrational behavior.
Yeah, the sad thing is, and I think we talked about this a bit last week, there are lots of DS games that would be perfectly fine on the Wii U.
Yep.
And it'd be nice if they focused on those rather than the ones that kind of don't make sense. But
oh well.
Who can say? All right.
Pete writes, Twilight Princess begins with the hero in a, quote, fish-out-of-water scenario where he meets a funny but pragmatic rogue he's initially at odds with. Eventually, he learns to work together with them and comes to value his partner as a close friend and ally. This all culminates when, shortly after the big bad reveals itself, Midna leans on Link's shoulders and they share a brief glance as is to say, yeah, we got this, before turning their attention back to the Dark World monstrosity forming before them. So how far into Twilight Princess did you guys get before you realized you were playing a buddy cop movie? God damn it! Because now he's kind of right.
Here's my shield and my boomerang. I quit.
There you go.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a buddy cop movie right from the start because, I mean, she's... Midna's...
That's the cool thing about Midna is that she has a complicated relationship with Link. And she has a real personality.
Yeah, at least she's a character. Yeah, at least she's a character. She's not Tattle, Navi, right?
Where it's just
or Fi.
Hey! Or Fi. Yeah.
She probably is in a lot of ways a response to both the fairies and to Tetra on her stupid necklace thing that she makes Link wear.
Yeah.
Although Tetra has some personality, so I guess that's sort of the starting point for them, starting giving really personifying the support characters.
Yeah, I mean, I look at her as kind of the Shadow the Hedgehog of Link's sidekick.
No, stop. Next email.
She's cool and has an attitude. Burr. She's a rude, not a dude, but whatever.
God, she's got a rude dude. All right, the next email is from Hey Einstein. And Hey Einstein writes, Dear RFN boys, a fool and his money are easily parted. I just had a birthday that coincided with the Kirby sale on the European eShop. So I've gone from owning two Kirby games that I've never played to owning all of the console, Game Boy, and GBA entries in the series.
Wow. Well done.
And yes, I even booted up Wii Mode to get the N64 game. I figured I was in that deep. Why not finish it? Mm-hmm. I put this down to a mix of curiosity and envying the Kirby Anniversary Collection that didn't come out over here in Europe. My question is for Guy. Where do I start? Which Kirby title should I prioritize? Which should I put at the bottom of my backlog? Thanks, as always, for doing the show.
I don't know. I would say the easiest answer is really start with the first GB game. It's probably you're going to be done in half an hour. And then what? Well, probably... Actually, I don't like the NES game. Kirby's Adventure? The more I go back to it, the more I realize the controls are really, really bad. And for a while, I thought maybe it's because of the NES, like the slowdown and stuff like that. Maybe that makes the controls less responsive. But the 3D version, the 3D Classics version on the 3DS does away with the slowdown, and the controls are just as bad. So just avoid that. I don't know. My favorites are...
I cannot concur with that.
No, I disagree. I disagree. My favorites
are Superstar, especially if you've got someone to play co-op. Otherwise, it's just so single player. And my favorites are really just the latest ones. So Kirby Return to Dream Land is really, really good and really fun single player. It's got these challenge mode... challenges for each power-up that are really, really... demanding and really test your abilities, and they're kind of like semi puzzle-ish, but you know, you've got to execute everything perfectly to get platinum medals in them. It's awesome, and the main game is awesome too.
Return to Dreamland is also a Wii game that I would buy day one if it came out on the virtual not on the virtual console, but on the Wii U. Because the last time I checked, which wasn't too long ago, that game's like $40 or $50 to get a disc. Mm-hmm. And that's the only way you can get it right now. So if they let us download that for $10 or $15, I'd be all over it.
But yeah, I would just, I don't know, maybe don't start with the best. So go ahead and play Dreamland 2, which is really forgettable, in my opinion. And I don't like the N64 game at all. Like, I know that you guys, you guys are like, you
why
like,
did you write this email to Guillaume?
I'm sorry, it's too slow of a game. It's really, really slow.
You don't like Epic Yarn either, do you?
It's okay, it's fun co-op. I don't know if I would play it by myself.
I'm crying. Kirby is crying, Guillaume. Kirby.
Yeah, you hate all the best Kirby games.
Kirby is in tears.
What do you know about the best Kirby
Nightmare
games?
Nightmare is winning.
Wow.
What do I know?
We have a Kirby pissing contest here. This is something new on the internet, I think.
I don't even consider myself like a big Kirby fan, but holy shit.
It's all about the arc.
Oh, man. Well, it's a very divided fan base, I guess, for Kirby games.
Apparently.
Please write back with your opinion on these games once you're done with them.
John, next email, please.
Save us.
Okay, thank you. Okay, all right. So Leo writes, I was just listening to RFN, and there was a listener mail about portable games on Wii U VC. Wow, Advance Wars Days of Ruin is downloadable in Japan. Why aren't they making DS games downloadable across the board? This may be hard to believe, but I never had a DS, so I missed a lot of great games. I've played some on my 3DS. For example, I found and loved Days of Ruin, but I never got to play Dual Strike or either Zelda game. Why are they not releasing them on the eShop if they obviously can?
Hell of a question there.
Oh, God.
So, the answer I have... is ultimately, we don't necessarily know what technical hurdles they had to jump through to make this work. In theory, a DS game should work on a 3DS. Just go. Oh, in theory, you could also bundle up a DS game into a DSiWare game and release it that way. There are some limited memory constraints on what how big DSiWare can be based on hardware memory and what it can put into the cache. Cache is probably the wrong word. I apologize for those of you who understand how 3DS architecture works. But you know, it there may be some technical hurdles that made that let Advance Wars Days of Ruin work where some other games wouldn't. I don't know, but I think ultimately the answer is that they can't get the experience they want to give. This thing was released as the equivalent of a Club Nintendo reward, I believe. So
yes,
so it may just be that they can't produce the experience they feel is necessary for what you're doing here. So ultimately, it could be technical. It could just be Nintendo being Nintendo, in the same way that we have Game Boy Advance games as part of the Ambassador Collection, but we never really got them as virtual console games on 3DS.
Do you ever wonder if maybe they just don't have enough people to do this stuff?
Oh, absolutely.
You know, they've got so many games at this point, like hundreds and hundreds of games that people want to be ported and remade and, you know, released on these services all the time. And it has to kind of almost be redone every 4 or 5 years when they bring, because they don't have this unified architecture. So every time they launch a new system, now it's, you know, we got to do Virtual Console all over again, and all this stuff has to be reported.
And even if they did, they'd probably have to do some degree. Excuse me, they have to do some degree of hand-holdiness just to make sure the stuff still works the way you expect it to. The if I recall correctly, NST was doing Virtual Console stuff for them for a while, and that's a tiny team. I mean, so, yeah, there is a real prospect here that part of the problem is they just don't have the staff they need to make this thing work the way it needs to work to be a viable and vibrant platform.
Yeah.
That sucks.
All right. Guillaume, next email, please.
John, aka Panderadox, writes, "Hey guys, provided Nintendo's foray into mobile supplements for their games, where do you think Amiibos stand in this picture? Apple and Android phones have NFC, and it seems like a great link between these two. Could we see Amiibo applications on mobile, or mobile NFC use with a gamepad?"
If Amiibo's still going hot when these things start coming out, I mean, there's no reason not to. It gives them an additional channel to say, hey, you should buy an Amiibo.
Yeah.
Are they definitely compatible with the NFC chips that are in people's phones?
The NFC on the gamepad is just generic. I mean, NFC, it is my understanding that it is a not generic, but it is an industry standard NFC. Right. That may not be the case. But if it is, then yes, I think we'll see some of this stuff pop on through. But you raise a valid point that it might not be. That Nintendo may have done some kind of weird protectionism on it.
I'm sure the signature, the radio signature that they put out over the NFC chip is encrypted to some, you know, some format that Nintendo only has. Because they don't want people hacking into these things. But they could just give you a mobile app that includes the decryption,
right?
You know, and if they can make that secure, then why not make an Amiibo reader just in software? Like if the hardware is compatible on a base level, then they could do some things to make your phone be able to read it.
But ultimately, the counter argument to my own point of, hey, it's another vector to sell these things, is ultimately the Amiibo don't really seem to be selling from a game standpoint. They're just selling because, holy shit, they're going to be hard to find. So, because, I mean, it's not a compelling game situation to buy a lot of these yet, and yet they still sell out. So
yeah, it's more of a completionist thing.
So maybe it's kind of a non-issue. I mean, I could see it as more of a mechanism to sort of unify their branding. And if they intend on increasing the number of physical products that they produce that have Amiibo tokens in them, then it sort of gives them a nice brand synergy of all their divisions playing nicely together.
Hey, at what point do they do Amiibo Lite? And it just doesn't have the chip.
I think that's the opposite direction of what they would do. I think I think you'll see more reduction of things. I mean, the chip isn't what's constraining.
What if Amiibo
production
becomes just the toy brand, and it's popular, and people want to buy Amiibos because they want to buy Amiibos, and they don't even know or care
chip's not what's constraining production, though. I mean, that's
probably not, but it does have a cost associated with it.
Not much.
At some point, maybe it's nominal. I don't know. But anyway, I just feel like, you know, it comes down to whether Nintendo is really serious about the gaming applications of Amiibo, or whether they consider Amiibo support on their platforms to be sort of a nominal thing that they have to show that they give you something to do with it. But that's really just so you can kind of trick yourself into thinking that you're buying video games when you're actually buying toys.
When was the last time that they talked about the kind of portal that you could add to your old, you know, your old 3DS?
The last Nintendo Direct.
Oh, really?
It's
so it's still coming
out in time. Yeah, it's coming out in time for Animal Crossing. That
It looks like a hockey puck.
Okay.
Whatever Animal Crossing House Arrest someone called it. Apparently you
Animal
can never
Cross
go.
Use the Force Edition is what Carl
apparently you're
to.
Stuck in people's houses.
Yeah, because I feel like Amiibo right now is selling to collectors, but it can't really take off with Little Timmy again, but without that portal, without, you know,
yeah,
old 3DSs being compatible.
It's coming. It's just delayed.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is interesting that they haven't put as high a priority on it so far.
There's only two 3DS games that use it, though. Smash Brothers doesn't have it yet. The 3DS Smash Brothers hasn't been patched yet to support Amiibo.
Yeah, it has.
Has
right?
it? I don't think I so.
Thought. I have. Yeah, I don't know.
I think that's an upcoming update.
I don't have it.
Weird. And then it's really just Codename Steam.
Yeah.
There's just not so games far. Out there to support the thing yet.
That's true. Yeah, maybe that'll end up being a big holiday push for them. You know, maybe by then they'll kind of have their shit sorted out from supply and
yeah,
because it seems like they're gonna want to make Amiibo part of the big holiday.
I would imagine they will.
That seems wise, which they didn't do last year, even though they were technically out, you know, before Christmas. They were so limited and there was so little support for them that it wasn't really an established product.
Well, and it had just come out about a month earlier, and I don't think they understood what was about to happen.
Right, yeah. So I wonder if this Christmas Amiibo ends up being kind of a big tentpole of Nintendo strategy, which would be interesting. It'd be interesting to see what kind of bending around they would have to do to try to sell that to, you know, to people who haven't already bit into it. Because, you know, in order to make this a big mainstream push – part of their holiday thing, then they're going to have to widen the appeal of it, I feel like. And I just wondered, did they do that on the toy side? Do they do that on the game side?
Are Marths back in the house?
Yeah.
Manny writes, I was wondering, if you could reminisce the time Square announced that they were going to make games for Nintendo again with Crystal Chronicles and Fund Q, how big a deal was it for the industry? Was it something that no one ever expected? P.S. I love the timer spam matches with Jigglypuff. James, you're evil. Good luck. Well, good luck's kind of a, well, we already
James,
lost.
So much
evil.
For that.
Yeah,
you'll
but
always be evil, James. Don't
those,
worry.
Those
no
matches,
one can take that away
those matches
from you.
Are, I'm proud of them. I'm
They're
proud
hilarious.
Of the work I did.
They're hilarious, and the strategy was completely effective. It worked out beautifully. It's a nice bit of work, for sure. But, man, you guys remember the Fund Q?
I do.
Development studio?
Well... Sort of.
Owned by Hiroshi Yamauchi and run by, I guess...
It was Brownie Brown, wasn't it? Isn't this effectively where Brownie Brown came from?
They're tied up in it in a weird way, but no. I don't think it's exactly the same. I remember this. I think I was director of the website when this happened back in 2005, it would have been. Maybe 2004. And it was a huge... At first, it seemed like the sky was the limit. This was, at the time, the wound of Square leaving Nintendo was still fairly fresh. It was only a few years earlier, in the mid to late 90s, that happened. And it had destroyed Nintendo in a lot of people's eyes. I mean, it had taken away this massive thing that a lot of people really cared about on Nintendo platforms. And it went from being this wasn't a multi-platform deal. This was... All of Square's games were on Nintendo, on Super Nintendo, and then they were all on PlayStation. Mm-hmm. So there's a huge fan base that just migrated, you know, or were left behind and feeling frustrated, which a lot of us were for at least a couple years until we got a PlayStation.
That
created a generation of multi-platform gamers out of Nintendo fans.
Yeah, I think bitterness, especially under the, you know, in terms of Nintendo fans, people are still bitter at Square Enix. That won't go away.
Today.
That was something that, I mean, that is, you can't erase that, you know?
Absolutely. So I found the fate of Fund Q. Fund Q, the assets that were Fund Q after Yamauchi departed the company were put under the leadership of, in a new startup, of Manabu Yamana, who had made DQ7, and carried the name Genius Sonority.
Uh-huh.
So they were all rolled into that new app, that new company, which now makes Pokemon spinoffs for Nintendo.
Yep. Yep.
Or Denpomen Radars.
And Denpomen, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, the Denpomen, yes.
And 100 classic book collection.
the news that Square was coming back to Nintendo was initially ecstatic. You know, we couldn't believe that it was finally happening. Then, of course, all of us started to wonder, wait, what does this look like? They're going through these crazy Japanese business machinations of creating shell companies and,
oh, yeah,
you know, swapping stocks and crazy bullshit like that. Square saying that they're not going to just port Sony games over to GameCube, but instead they're going to make new games for the Nintendo audience, which is always kind of a trigger phrase. And they're going to, you know, get into this weird GBA connectivity stuff with Chris. I mean, you know, it very quickly turned from, well, this is the greatest news ever, and they're going to make a new Chrono Trigger, and the next big Final Fantasy could be a GameCube exclusive, or at least we'll get a multi-platform version of FF12 or 13 or whatever, and none of that happened. Instead, what it ended up being was kind of an excuse to put Square games on the GBA and the DS, which Square wanted very well at the time, just GBA, but eventually
right.
DS, which it turned out to be incredibly lucrative for them and was a big deal for the company. And they knew that those games would sell to that audience and on that platform, and that they had a lot of money to make. And Nintendo basically strong-armed them and said, the only way we're going to let you make GBA games is if you also make GameCube games. And eventually Wii games. And
they were doing that for other people too. Like that was the reason a lot of GameCube third-party games, multi-platforms came out, was because they still needed access to that GBA market. And then I said, well, guess what?
Yeah. And so we ended up getting these kind of weird offshoot Final Fantasy games and a few other things on the console that never, I mean, some of them are good games, some of them are not good games, but it never amounted to the kind of support that we were dreaming of at the time, you know? And I will say, though, on the handheld front, it was a huge success. I mean, I was delighted to get those Final Fantasy games on GBA, and then they made the new ones. They started porting over the Super Nintendo or the Super Famicom Dragon Quest games to DS, and then also localizing them in English. I mean, I couldn't have been more happy with that. But on the console side, it definitely didn't amount to much.
Yeah, I mean, FundQ was I mean, its stated goal was to fund these startup games that are about connectivity. Mm-hmm. And that was actually really more of the trigger word than we thought, because ultimately what it really was about giving these companies who weren't making GameCube games access to making GameCube games in order to get GBA access. Mm-hmm. Like, the connectivity was really just the shell term for what was actually just extortion.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. It's a weird thing that happened in the world about 10 years ago. It was a really strange deal to watch. And we kind of all knew that that's what it was, you know, when it was happening.
Deep down, yeah, I think we all – I mean, I wasn't on the site at that point, but I knew.
I felt shame.
Like, it was – I will say, you know, you talked about the games that came out of that deal. There really weren't that many, but no. Dragon Quest Swords. There you go.
Many more on the handhelds. That came out of the deal. And that, it, you know, in the long run, it benefited both companies a lot. Square is still releasing 3DS games, one of the few big Japanese publishers to be doing that. And they're having some success on there, and thank goodness. Because there's not a whole lot of third-party much of anything on 3DS. Square's holding it down. Square and Atlas, really, out of Japan. So anyway, that's going to wrap up the Thunder Round of Listener Mail. And as always, you can send your letter, and we wish that you would. Send your email on just about any topic, especially video games. You can send that to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And if you can't remember that, go to the website, click on the article for this episode. There's a link right there every week, I promise.
What's the website?
What's that link again?
Mm-hmm. The website.
I'm trying to click the podcast. Fact, it's not working.
The website, in fact, is nintendoworldreport.com, which you should go to this week as you listen to this show, because we're going to be having some really big coverage of Splatoon. There's a Nintendo Direct coming up, and you can bet that we'll have lots of analysis of all that new information, and it'll be covered in the podcast and everything. So definitely go check that out.
Don's will have some impressions from Xenoblade Chronicles X as well.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, that just came out in Japan. Yep, that's big. I'm excited. Not too often that we have a really big import game that's worth having its own coverage of.
It looks so good, too.
Oh, man. I'm excited for that game. Big time. Okay. Well, that's it. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We'll talk to you next time right here on Radio Free Nintendo.
Bye.
Later.
Bye.